We're starting a new month. So each month we go through a different link. 12 links, 12 months. We're starting this new month on attachment. Craving, it's what it's called. It's a thin line between this month and next month. Thin line. Really, the only difference is intensity. So I'm sitting here, been thinking and contemplating on this for 2 days now. And I am hesitant, I guess, to say the least, around how to talk about attachment. Because if you've ever had any degree of practice, we have a lot of preset judgments and thoughts about attachment, what it is. I mean, you cannot have a Dhamma talk. You can't even be in the Dhamma world without hearing some Dhamma talk on attachment, craving, clinging. It's all wound up in there. And I just kept thinking, I am going to be battling against your preset way of thinking about what attachment is. So I kept looking in the suttas to see if I could find something different, some different way to say it. I love talking about the Dhamma in a different way, some new way. You haven't heard, you haven't thought of it before. Like, oh, what's that? What are you talking about? That's not the way we talk about attachment. What are you talking about? That's not craving. And I couldn't find anything. But I found one of my favorite suttas. And I'd like to talk about attachment from that sutta because I don't think there's any writing anywhere that expresses how important this topic is, unlike this sutta. There's just no, we don't have any expression that explains it as succinctly and as to the point as I think this sutta does. So I thought I would go back and do a little overview, and then we're going to talk about this sutta. I'm going to share my screen here if this works. So you can see. This cyclical thing we're in here. Well, can everybody see that? Are we okay? You can see it? Okay. So this is the year that we're talking about. And if we were at Sim's physical location, you could remember this and see this. This is what we've been dealing with. So up here in January, we started with ignorance, which is this basic walking around without paying attention to what's going on. This inability to be aware of how serious the danger is that we are trapped in as a egoic society, a society or a world that builds its movement, thought, expression, everything about us is egoic. It comes out of the ego, and we rely on that ego and we live in that ego. And out of this ignorance is what it's called, but it's this inability to see how driven we are to get what we want and to not have what we don't want. We don't see that drive itself. To point to it, if I go over to the suffering side, just before we get to this ignorance, we can feel the suffering, but the ignorance is such that we can't remember. It's like having children. Women will tell you, you've had more than one kid. You don't remember the pain of that pregnancy, that birthing process, until right before you get ready to go into labor. And then you're like, that's right. This is painful. I didn't want to do this anymore. I swore I wasn't going to do this again. So somehow the mind, our minds for women completely obscure that pain of a birth so that you don't remember. And when you get pregnant, you're all happy. I can't wait. When the baby comes, there's all this good energy. Until right before that ninth month, you begin to remember something. Like, I remember something about this pregnancy. And then you start remembering, oh yeah, that's right, I wasn't gonna do this. So that's what that ignorance is. It clouds our minds. And connected to this ignorance is this mental formation. And I hope this isn't boring. I hope it's, I don't know if Tim went through this, but it's important where we are now to begin to understand how we got here and where we're going to go. So this ignorance is attached to our sort of recognition and memories, our thoughts, the habit patterns of our lives. A word I'm going to use later, I'm going to say now, is this ignorance and mental formation, you could think of it as a giant imprint stamp that puts its stamp on our lives. It's imprinted into our minds. This imprint leads into a level of consciousness, connects us to this internal function. And these next five links, this consciousness, this name and form, the senses, including our thoughts, it says five here, but in Dhamma, it's six, including thoughts. And this contact, all of these four things are glued together by where we were last month. They're glued together by this feeling of a liking and not liking. Our desires are pointing us towards our own preferences of the way we want to be, and we like this or we don't like this. And this glued together, this glued together body we have begins to stick. It's sticky. And it begins to stick onto everything around us. We wake up in the morning, we set in motion all of this, and then we go through life just sticking and attaching ourselves to everything. All this liking, don't liking, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And this is a great photo of what craving does. Because it puts us in this place where we are stuck to something we want, regardless of what we know is gonna be of benefit to us or not. We just get stuck. We're stuck basically in this up here. The imprint that got set here, we then get stuck to it, and that's where we become attached. That's probably the best way I can think of explaining attachment. It is a being stuck to a previous imprint in our minds, in our thinking, in our ego. And so we can't see that we're stuck. It's a previous imprint. So it seems right. It seems, oh, this is the way I'm supposed to be. But this stuck place that we get to next month, when we talk about this inability to let go of it, is what's going to keep us trapped into this cyclical world of samsara. We're stuck in it. We can practice the Dhamma and still be stuck in it. You know this. I know this. I've been practicing the Dhamma for 30 years and I'm still stuck in it. That is not a sign that I'm slow. It's not what that's a sign of. It's the nature of what we're dealing with. So you can see if I fear that if I have a egoic intellectual conversation about attachment, it gets filed into our intellect. And it's like, yeah, that's something I want to know. But we'll wake up tomorrow morning getting stuck with our imprints all over the place and never once question it. In fact, the only time we ever question the getting stuck is when we don't like it. That's it. As long as things are going easy and smooth, we don't question nothing. This is the way it's supposed to be. Finally, my life is coming together. Things are coming right. And then a pandemic hits. All of a sudden, it's like, we don't like it. So now it feels like everything is uncertain. Now it feels like, oh my God, I don't know what's going to happen. It's always been like that. It was never certain, but it felt certain because the imprint of the way our previous egoic thinking sets us up to believe we are in some kind of permanently structured world. It is a total setup. Any day before March of this year, you could have woke up, got yourself ready just to go to the store, quick run to the store, and I'll be right back. And you could step outside on that sidewalk, step outside in the street, no cars, step outside, and a drunk driver could come around the corner, change your whole world, just like that. Any moment that could have happened. You have no imprint of that, so we didn't think that was going to happen. You could have woke up one day and felt some lump and say, what's that? I didn't feel that before. And then you go to the doctor, find out you have cancer. Where did that come from? I've been eating right, exercising. I don't even smoke. Where does this come from? It's not supposed to happen to me, but it could. And the only time we realized we were attached to the life that we had is when it is no more. But that is a dangerous way to live. It is a life built in suffering because the pain of finding out you have cancer or getting hit by a drunk driver or finding out there's some pandemic that's going to just completely shift our understanding. The only reason why this is bad is because we have been living in attachment. We have been living in the imprint that what we thought was a permanent world, and it's not until we see that it's not, that everything gets all shaken up. Attachment, this craving, it comes out of these sense doors Remember when we talked about the sense doors, when we talked about this name and form, and we get into these sense doors and the contact with them, these sense doors are not just, oh, I can see, I can hear, I can smell, I can touch, I can think. That's just who I am. They are little, little antennas, looking around for something to attach to, something that it likes. It's looking for the knowing of our life. Because not theoretically, I was going to say theoretically, but in actuality, we live in darkness. We don't know we live in darkness because we have these little antennas and they go around in the sense doors. And oh, my living room looks like my living room. I know I can see these things. I see these things every day. This is my living room. Oh, I'm in my world. I'm in my place. So these little sense doors, they contact all these little things in our world and reassure us that we are living in everything is where it's supposed to be. Everything is steady. It's not. It's not at all. It never was steady. This is what Buddha saw. This is what he saw when he awakened. He didn't see it intellectually. Oh, I think something's amiss here. That's where he was when he left home. He saw, I think something's amiss here. Something's not really right. Something's, it's got to be more than this. What the Buddha saw when he awakened was impermanent. Impermanence. He saw that nothing stays the same. Nothing is permanent. As much as we look at our apartment or our house and we think it's permanent, it's not. Anything could happen. That getting hit by that DUI could completely disrupt our ability. I guess you don't get hit by the DUI. You get hit by the driver who is having a DUI. Okay, but my point is you can get hit by that car and now you can't go to work. And before long, you are no longer in your house. It can happen pretty quick. Your life can be changed. And what you think of as your house, your apartment, can be completely changed. This is what I think Buddha saw. This is what I think he saw. The thing that he saw that had never been seen before when he got awakened was this impermanence. And when he saw the impermanence and just let it be, he experienced a level of relief, release that we rarely get to tap into. But sometimes when you're sitting quietly, sometimes when you're not trying to have a particular sit the way you want it, sometimes when you just let the sit be however it is, you'll notice that pain arises and passes away, that it comes and goes, that it connects and it doesn't connect. So I want to talk about the sutta. It's called the Ayachana Sutta. It's what happened with the Buddha. It's a little story about something that happened to the Buddha after he awakened. After he awakened, he had this understanding, this wisdom. And he saw, what the hell? That's what I've been living in? Yeah, that's not okay. He was in seclusion. And what I think he saw, this attachment is what he saw. And I think that attachment is the most important aspect of Dhamma, of dependent origination, of just awakening in general. So he was in seclusion. And just sitting there, you know, if you don't remember, if you ever heard this, but when the Buddha awakened, he spent a week walking around the tree that he sat under and bowing and offering gratitude to the tree. I mean, so this is how deep he has gotten. He's in a whole nother realm of existence, a whole nother realm of understanding. So he is sitting in seclusion. And a thought comes to him. This is what his thinking was. This Dhamma that I have attained is deep, hard to see, hard to realize. It's peaceful and refined. Beyond the scope of conjecture, it's subtle to be experienced by the wise. So he knows what he has just gone through, where he is now at, is at a highly refined state. And then he thinks, but this generation delights in attachment, is excited by attachment, enjoys attachment. And for a generation delighting in attachment, excited by attachment, enjoying attachment, this and that conditionality and dependent origination are hard to see. What he's saying, we don't see this conditionality. We don't see or even contemplate the possibility that a drunk driver can come around the corner and change our lives. We don't see that this pandemic could come. Not like people haven't told us forever and a day, warned us, I should say, but we don't see it. We don't see this growing lump that's happening in our breast. We don't see that. So because we don't see it, we don't quite get the conditionality, the this and the that that's coming together. So he goes on. For this generation, delighting in attachment, excited by attachment, enjoying attachment, this and that, conditionality and dependent co-arising are hard to see. This state too is hard to see. The resolution of fabrication, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, and this unbinding. It's hard to see that too. So he thinks to himself, if I were to teach the Dhamma, and if others would not understand me, that would be tiresome for me and troublesome for me. Right? So it's like he's looking at Tuere and he's saying, oh my God, if I have to teach her the Dhamma and she does not understand what I'm saying, that's going to just wear me out. I just don't know if I can put it up with it. He thought, enough now of this teaching, what only with difficulty I reached. This Dhamma is not easily realized by those overcome with aversion and passion. What an abstruse, subtle, deep, hard to see, going against the flow. Those delighting in passion, cloaked in the mass of darkness, won't see. And as the Buddha reflected upon this, his mind inclined towards dwelling at ease, not teaching the Dhamma. Right? His mind inclined to just stay in this seclusion, this place where he had reached an understanding, and not teach the Dhamma. So if you don't mind, I want you to close your eyes and I want you to think for a moment. I want us to take a moment. Think about this. Think about the pain you feel when you get trapped in aversion. You don't like something. Think about all the political arguments you have had with people, or all the arguments you've had about to mask or not to mask. Think about all of the passion you have about social justice, what's right, what's wrong. Just take a few minutes and think about this. Think about it in terms of the arguments you've had. How much stuff has happened in your life and you did not like it? The irritation, the frustration. But also think about all the things you love about life. Could be your apartment, your house, you love it, your vacation, that you have enough money to take care of everything, your grandkids, your children, all these things, all these ways in which you love life, food, good food, sex, you love your husband, your wife, your partner. Think about it. It could be your favorite book. You love this movie, this song, some art. Maybe step back a little bit and think about who you were before the Dhamma came to you. Before you really got into it. Before you thought, I want to learn that. I think this can help me. Just think a moment about how trapped you could feel in life. Can you sense how the Buddha's mind could incline towards just seclusion, this ease? Could you consider how nice it would be if things were just peaceful? And when you're ready, you could open your eyes again. the Buddha was not the first Buddha, nor was he the last. What made the Buddha that we know him as, is his self-awakening process and what he did after this. See, if the Buddha had stayed where he was, the world would be very different. And there was a Brahmin who heard, a Brahmin would be like what we would consider in our world a heavenly being. He heard the Buddha thinking, enough of this, it's too troublesome. I can't try to explain something that's so sublime to people that are so caught up in aversion and passion. It's like, you think you could listen to somebody when you're arguing with that family member about whether they should wear a mask? And someone comes and says, you know, let it go. Just let that go. You're attached to some understanding. Let it go. We think we're right. We don't think we're attached. We think we're right. What do you mean? It's dangerous. Of course, anybody should know that. There's no letting go. That's like, you know, just ignoring reality. Or I can't do that. That's just, you know, you're in denial, whatever we say to ourselves. But we're still stuck in the pressure of the fight that we're having. So this Brahmin hears the Buddha's words. He hears him thinking. And he hears the Buddha say, enough with this teaching. What only with difficulty I reach. Enough with that already. It's not easily realized by people with aversion and passion. It's too obtuse, too subtle, too deep. Enough of that. I'm just going to incline back into the ease of my awakened mind. And this heavenly being, this Brahmin, he shows himself to Buddha. And when he shows himself, well, first he thinks while he's in heaven, oh, shit, he's like, the world is lost. Oh, wait. Siddhartha is about to say, no, the world is, this is what he says, the world is lost. The world is destroyed. The mind of the Tathagata, the Arhat, the rightly self-awakened one, inclines to dwelling at ease, not to teaching the Dhamma. Oh, no. Oh, my God. Just think of all those little icons. OMG, WTF, what the hell? Wait. That's what he's saying. It's like, oh yeah, this cannot be. So he shows himself to the Buddha and he basically begs the Buddha, you have to teach. And the Buddha is thinking in his mind, it's too complicated. Too complicated. I can't explain this to people. They won't understand. But this Brahmin begs the Buddha to go and just open up his eyes and look upon the world the way one might look upon the world if they are high on a cliff. He says, in the past, this is what he tells the Buddha. In the past, there appeared among the, and I don't know this word, but I think he's saying human or the people of that, you know, human beings. So in the past, there appeared among the humans an impure Dhamma devised by the stained. Throw open the door of the deathless. Let them hear the Dhamma realized by an stainless one. So I can tell you Dhamma, I can tell you wisdom, but I have stains. I'm not awakened. It's going to be all mixed in there with opinion and thought and what I conjecture. And I'm going to piece together some little pieces, little bit of wisdom, and then I'm going to hook it up together with some ignorance. But still, this sounds good. This sounds good. But just ignore that little ignorance in the interim. So there's a way in which many sacred beings would take their limited wisdom, it's not awakened wisdom, and they would piece it together and share the Dhamma, share the truth of wisdom with the world. But what this Brahmin was saying to the Buddha is, your wisdom is unstained. It's complete. It's in its total understanding. You have to share that with the world. So the Buddha, he tells the Buddha, just as one standing on a rocky cliff might see people all around below, he asked him to ascend from this palace, this fashioned in the Dhamma, ascend from out of that sense of ease and seclusion and go and be among the people. So ascend from this palace that's fashioned of the Dhamma that's free from suffering and behold the people submerged in suffering, oppressed by birth and aging. Go look at them. And he tells them to rise up. O teacher, wander about without debt in the world and teach the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand. And so the Buddha, listening to this, he's a young man, the Buddha, actually, when he awakened. So listening to this elder, listening to this Brahmin, he then decides to go and look at people. And when he goes, he sees a whole bunch of sadness. One more piece I want to share. Is what he sees is, he sees that there's some people that have dust in their eyes and others who have with little dust and those with much dust, those with keen faculties and those with dull faculties, those with good attributes and those with bad, those who would be easy to teach and those who would be hard. And some of them, he sees disgrace and danger in the world. So Buddha comes to this understanding that the pain of what he is seeing is too much to bear. And he has compassion. And then he turns to teach the Dhamma. And when he agreed to teach the Dhamma, this Brahmin basically left. The reason why I want to share this story, the reason why I want to talk about attachment first from this framework, before we can talk about the details of attachment next week and the week after and the week after and the week after. And even though we'll be moving out of attachment into clinging come next month, it's still going to sound a lot the same because it's just a more intensified version of that. What I think I wanted to convey tonight, though, what seemed more important to me on this first night of stepping into attachment is that when the Buddha had compassion upon people, he decided to teach. Even though many people tried to kill him, it was troublesome to him. It was tiring to him. But many, 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 many people awakened by listening to the Buddha's teaching. So before the Buddha and after the Buddha, there have been Buddhas. But the Buddha that we know, I don't know if I said this. I think I was going to say it, but I don't know if I said it. The Buddha we know is significant because he came and taught people how to awaken. He didn't teach some opinionated sacredness about who I am. He didn't teach all of us, look, I'm so sacred. I have come to some understanding. You pay me money and then you can come hear the Dhamma. He didn't say it like that. He went down and he freely taught it to anybody and everybody. All that he asked of people was to just open your eyes so you can see, open this wisdom so that you could see the danger that we are in. We're trapped in this cyclical nature of suffering. Not because life is so bad. It's not because of the pandemic. It's not because there's social unrest everywhere. It's not because of that. It's because we are trapped in this mistaken belief that we shouldn't be in a pandemic. We shouldn't have this. We shouldn't have this social unrest. We've had social unrest in this world since history began. They probably had social unrest when somebody had fire and somebody did it, and then there's going to be this whole fight on how we're going to get it. It's always been social unrest. We have always had levels of illness and sickness that are contagious and that can take us down. I mean, I think it was just... somebody sent me a video right after this pandemic happened of the guy that did all this work on polio. And polio wasn't even eradicated fully until, I think it was 2 years ago, maybe even last year. It's pretty quick. We're talking about an illness that many of us don't even care about anymore. We don't even think about it. We hate to get the polio shot, but you got to get it when you're a kid. And then we all kind of get these little immunizations. And my kids probably have gotten so many polio shots. I used to lose their cards and then they'd have to go get the whole series. I figured they can't get sick. They're like covered in all kinds of immunizations. But we forget how difficult it was to eradicate polio and how long it took. And we had to live in the world, regardless of polio was there or not. We had to live in the world, even though it was terrifying to people. And I've seen some of the pictures of polio, and it is terrifying. The point I'm making is, it's not that I'm trying to poo-poo or dismiss the dangers of COVID, but what I'm trying to share with us is an understanding that COVID is not near as dangerous as the world of attachment that we live in. And that at some point, if we could learn to face this attachment with more, I guess, zeal would be the way, the word I want to say. If we could begin to try to see into the subtleness of this, the obscurity of it, then what it could do on our behalf in liberating the dust that could be in our eyes is far, far, far greater than staying clean away from somebody with COVID. Because I don't want to be the one to tell us. But yes, you might not get COVID, but you will die of something. I don't know when it's going to be. I don't know what it's going to be, but we can sidestep that. But we're only sidestepping that to be stepping over here. You walk outside, go into the grocery store, save from COVID, and get hit by a drunk driver. This Dhamma that we're learning is really designed for us to come together and remember and remind each other that there is a far bigger disease around us. And that disease is craving. It's attachment. And it's only going to get more intensive as we go through this month, as we go through this year. We don't even get to the transcendental liberating quality of co-arising until December. Let me see if there's something I want to say. I think I want to end with this. The next time you get caught in some battle with someone of a different opinion, if at all possible, feel that if. Look at the news until you get sick of it and you cannot look at it anymore. I'm so mad. I could just kill everybody. Just wipe up every, get rid of everybody. Just get that into it and feel how painful that is. Think about how painful it would be if you lost one of your family members. How painful it would be if you lost your job or you lost your house. Just think about all these things that you could lose and how painful it is. And then consider the compassion of the Buddha, who was dwelling in ease, secluded, good, righteous. Think of the compassion he had to come down and actually teach how to unhook ourselves from this attachment. And maybe we can begin to see the importance of practice beyond this understanding that, you know, I want to have a nice meditation sit and begin to see the potential of liberation in this understanding of co-arising. So let's just sit for a moment. Thank you so much for your kind attention. We do have a little time for some questions if people have them. It's kind of hard to have a question about attachment when you spent the whole time talking about one sutta, but that's okay. I will tell you a little bit about how to answer questions. Ask them. If you go to the participant thing at the bottom of the page and look at the bottom, if you click on that and look at the bottom, you'll see a little blue hand. You can use your little blue hand Or you can just unmute yourself and start talking, or raise your hand. Either way, we'll kind of see you. Oh, I see a couple hands here. All right. So let's see. Rob, is that you?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
So yeah, thank you for your talk.
Welcome.
Barry. I guess, when it's things that I'm averse to, that seems fairly obvious that I'm struggling with those things. But, you also talked about things that we love. You know, you mentioned mm-hmm. a whole bunch of pretty good things, you know, that we all tend to like to have in our life. And, I'm probably attached to a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
How do I know when I'm attached?
Pain. That's the best way to tell. It's only in our suffering. Rodney told me that a while back, that mostly we are asleep. And so until we get a level of appreciation for feeling discomfort, feeling uncomfortable, feeling pain, we won't know that we're attached, because we never notice. We don't think anything's wrong when things are going good, things we like. And it's when something changes that we get upset. So the reason why I think the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, are so ennobling is because the very first truth is the very first understanding, insight, is that there's suffering here. That's the doorway that we can begin to then say, oh, if there's suffering here, there's also attachment here. That's why I'm suffering, because I'm attached to something, either something that I don't want now, you know, I'm attached to something that's not here and I don't like what's here, or I'm attached to something that I wish was here and it's not here, but there is that attachment there. So if you use the suffering, the pain, as a doorway into beginning to look at what is the conditions that have given rise to this suffering in this moment, then you can begin to unhook yourself from the attachment. You won't change the circumstances, but you unhook yourself from the attachment and you can begin to change your relationship with those circumstances.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Suzanne?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
You just sort of addressed what I was gonna ask about too, because my mother died over 3 years ago, and that process of being close to death and the dying process was so incredible. And it poked at this hardcore. It just disintegrated it. And like, because the rugs ripped out from under you.
Yes.
And so I love, grief was my access point to the Dharma, and it's sort of my friend that's just sort of walks along with me. And I got to a point where I was at such sort of peace with impermanence before I really was even practicing, right? That I would go to bed at night and I would literally say, okay, everyone I know knows I love them. I'm at peace with my life up until this moment. And I would literally be able to say, like, if I don't wake up tomorrow, I'm at peace with it. I don't wake up. Like, if I walk out and the drunk driver hits me, that's what was supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh. So then it naturally arose, but then it shifted into clinging to oh, I felt that. I experienced that. It was like
I had something. Now it's gone.
I had something. Now it's gone. Oh, okay. okay, the Dharma, okay, this sit, okay, this retreat, okay, because it just arose. It just arose. It wasn't like something I was trying to get. Yeah. But I had that feeling of like, did I just have that thought that like, if I died tomorrow, like everyone knows I love them. And I was like, what? How did I, what? No, the ego freaking out. And it's just funny because last week's assignment was notice how much is initiated by Vedana. And I was like, everything. What do you mean notice how much? Damn. Like, it's like the water. It's like what you were saying at the beginning. It's like, I can't tell you this because you can't hear it without like, and it's literally after 48 hours, I was like, it's everything. It's there. And the only time it's not is when I can see it. Like I can see I'm in it. Oh, there I am. And I'm, my boss said that thing. Oh, look, here I am getting triggered right now at this. So then how do I not make her wrong? Okay, just step back, just notice. So I don't really have a question. It's like choosing, like being at peace with clinging and wanting, and it's never going to go away. And it's like, yeah. So anyway, that's all.
It is going to go away. Okay. It does go away, but you're right. It takes a long time. It's hard to realize. It's difficult. This is what the Buddha was pointing to. What I think he thought was, nobody is going to understand this and no one's going to put the energy in to try to begin to understand this. And I am just going to be poking at people that don't want to hear it. And what the Brahmin came down to say was, that's not true. There are many, 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 many people who have a little dust in their eyes and they want to hear it and they practice. So our job is not to make the attachment go away. We can't do that.
Yeah.
Our job is just to take attachment seriously so that we can continue to practice trying to see. Can you guys even see me? I got rid of my, I just realized it's gotten awfully dark all of a sudden. Let me just turn the light on a little bit. I am like total, I'm in total darkness. There. So that's what we're trying to see. We're just, it's like giving ourselves permission to take the time and practice with it, not expecting that we're gonna somehow or another make it, fix it really quick. The idea is it's a long process, gradual process. Even the Buddha, the awakening, he was a bodhisattva, if you believe in this thing, for many lifetimes. So he was born into a life where he was going to be the Buddha, but he was a bodhisattva for a long, long time. The idea though is to take the practice seriously. I think that's what I wanted to convey, is to take it serious, because there was a moment in time when we wouldn't have even had this knowledge of being able to free ourselves, because the Buddha would have just stayed in seclusion. Many Buddhas stayed in seclusion. Many Buddhas before him and after him, they reached enlightenment and they never shared it with anybody else. They just stayed in seclusion. So the fact that he came back and risked everything and lots of things, people, you know, got mad at him. And there's all kinds of stories about, you know, Buddha would take there's a story where, I don't see any hands, so I can kind of tell you these things, but there's a story where a slave was brought to the Buddha with the master, the Brahmin who had a slave. the Brahmin wanted to come and join the Buddha's group, and he wanted to be a disciple of the Buddha. He brought a slave with him, and the Buddha said, "Well, if you come, then are you bringing the slave? It's his choice too if he comes or not." And he goes, "Oh yes, yes, yes. He comes." And the Buddha says, "No, no, no. He has to choose whether he wants to be included. You want to be included?" And the guy's looking at his master like, "Do I want to be included?" It's like, okay, yes, I want to be included." So the Buddha said, "Okay, now if you join, it's my rules. You do what I say. And if you can't do that, then this is not for you." So this Brahmin says, no, I'm down. I'm doing your rules all the way." So the slave says, me too. I'm doing your rules all the way." So the Buddha, in his wisdom, he said, "My first rule is you, the Brahmin, have to take care of him, the slave. You have to do whatever he wants, wash his clothes, get his stuff together, fix his meals." The Brahmin is like, "What? Oh yeah, no, we can't do that. No. I thought I could do it, Venerable Sir, but you know, I can't do it. I'm sorry." Buddha said, "That's okay, I understand. It's difficult. Come back whenever you're ready." Brahmin gets up and he's leaving, looks at his slave, says, "Let's go." And the Buddha said, no. He chooses whether he goes. Of course, the slave said, "You have to come and stay with this guy. Something about him. I think I'm going to stay here." And the Brahmin had to leave without him. I mean, these are the kinds of ways that the Buddha would disrupt the system that he was in. A friend of mine who's South Asian, she said that she was pointing out in the Dhammapala where the Buddha, Brahmins are, we don't have this kind of understanding so much in our lives, but Brahmins were born Brahmins. So you were born into whatever caste you were born into, you're born into that. So you're born a Brahmin. And the Brahmin's the highest caste. So you're like born into holiness, I guess you could say. Not so much like kings or queens, but you're born into a sense of somehow you've proven yourself as being a great being because you're born a Brahmin. But the Buddha in the Dhammapada rattled off all these things like, if you are kind, that's who he would consider a Brahmin. If you renounced, you know, if you lived a renunciate life, that's who he considered a Brahmin. If you did acts of kindness, that's what he considered a Brahmin. And he lists all these things that any being could do, and Buddha would consider him a Brahmin. I know that had to shake the world of his people around him. Or the last story I want to say is there's a famous guy named Angulimala who went around killing all these people. All these villagers, Angulimala would kill. He was trying to get, I think, 100 or 1,000 deaths. And he would keep the ear or the finger of the person that he killed so that he could take it to his teacher and show him that he killed all these beings. And he tried at some point, he's going to kill his mom as the last being, and then he makes his golden number, and he comes upon the Buddha, and the Buddha says, you gotta stop. You gotta stop what you're doing here. And so, you know, he has an exchange with Angulimala, and Angulimala is so impressed with the Buddha, he decides to follow the Buddha, becomes one of his disciples. So of course they're going on alms rounds to get something to eat, and everybody sees Angulimala. He's got robes on, but you know, it's like, that's the guy that killed my mom. That's the guy that killed my brother. And so they are throwing rotten eggs at him. They're throwing rocks at him. They give him poisonous food. They do all the stuff. And the Buddha is saying, you don't have to come on alms rounds with us. Angulimala people don't understand who you are. Now, you don't need to come on alms rounds with us. And he says, yes, I am coming on alms rounds because this is what I got to deal with. And some people even thought that Buddha died from poison, either bad food or poisoned food, and they thought it was meant for Angulimala. So the point that I'm making is that it's not like the Buddha did not come down into the world where he had compassion and didn't experience a lot of difficulty. He did. A lot of difficulty. But there's something to me about reaching some level of understanding and freely giving it out. It's so foreign to our understanding. It was not his retirement plan. I mean, we know so many people that have come up with some wisdom, and you pay good money to get that wisdom. Whatever it is, you got to pay for it. We're not getting no free wisdom here. And yet the Buddha would give out so much wisdom freely. So much of it. He gave it freely to people. And he maintained his level of compassion no matter what happened. And so all I want to convey is that since we're coming into this attachment and we're coming into this craving, not to just hold this next 2 months in the, oh yeah, I know what attachment is. Oh yeah, I know what craving is. To hold it seriously, because this is the root of how we can free ourselves from the spinning around in the mind. And I don't want to also put it in such a framework that it seems too far to even get. It's just to take it seriously when you notice you are attached. When you notice these things that we're going to talk about starting next week, when you notice it, take it seriously. That's all I want to convey. So that when we practice, we're practicing together and we're really beginning to see what's possible outside of our limited thinking. All right, good peoples. I don't know why this sutta came to me like early this morning, and that was it. It was like this, I kept trying to ignore it and write something else. I was like, no, this is a sutta we got to talk about. So we'll talk a little bit more on the normal Dhamma talk next week. But anyway, so I hope it was beneficial. I hope it sets in motion a new 2 months. All right. Thank you so much. I got to save some time for Rob, who's going to come and talk about some announcements.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tweri. Loved your talk tonight. Definitely beneficial to me.
Good, good.
I think this attachment and craving stuff is really where the rubber hits the road, at least for me. So thank you. And I even chuckled a few times. So that
that's good.
That's always good. So, hi, everybody. I'm Rob Long. I'm a SIMS board president. And it's my pleasure tonight to make a few announcements. I'm going to put something in the chat at the end with links to everything. So hopefully you can find stuff easy. And if you have any questions, feel free to email me. I'll also include my email. So August 15th, we have a day of mindfulness with Tim Guile. And, you know, this is sort of officially the conclusion of the introductory meditation class. But, you know, from our experienced practitioners, it's also a great way to sort of boost your practice and also to support our students. So please consider attending that on August 15th. On August 19th, we have month 3 of the Buddhist Essential Series. And this month, I believe it's the Eightfold Path being taught by Jerry Harder and Suze Appel. August 20th to the 24th, there's kind of an outside event that I wanted to announce. It's an outdoor wilderness meditation retreat near Eugene, Oregon, held by a teacher named Justin Michelson, who is the son of one of our Sangha members and former presidents, Joyce Michelson. And so this looks pretty neat. It's limited to 25 people. You know, it's outdoors, so presumably it's COVID safe. I'll include a link to that. August 20th, 21st and 22nd, we have a Friday night talk and Saturday day long with Tina Rasmussen, a visiting teacher on concentration meditation, which is, you know, an important topic in Buddhist meditation. September 11th, and then the weekend of the 12th and the 13th, we have the Venerable Panavati visiting. And I don't know if any of you have ever seen her, but she is just awesome. I love her. She's a Christian pastor, I believe, and also an ordained Buddhist monk. And she just has a very unique and engaging style. So please consider that event. So that's all I have really as far as events. So one thing I just wanted to say was that Shashi Karen, one of our board members, is leaving the board. And Shashi has been on the board for 4 years as treasurer. And I just want to encourage everybody, you know, to send thanks or virtual thanks and well wishes to Shashi, because he has just been wonderful, you know, keeping SEM's finances, you know, in line and healthy and legal and all that sort of stuff. And not only that, he's a good friend. He's been just really solid on the board, and we're all going to miss him. So his replacement is going to be Cheryl Nguyen, and we can introduce her, you know, at another time, but we're very thankful to have Cheryl coming on board in September. So the last thing I just want to say is to please consider the Donna baskets. SEM's, you know, is completely reliant on your donations. SEM's will, of course, never turn anybody away for, you know, an inability to donate or make anybody feel less. But if you are able to donate, I would ask that you consider that. And you can go to seattleinsight.org/donate. And I would also especially ask that you consider donating to our teachers. Because, you know, with COVID, their ability to teach and earn income has been severely impacted. So at that page, you can, there's links to donate directly to Tim Mantueri. And so please consider that. And that's all I have. So I'm looking forward to the next couple of months. And we'll see everybody. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Rob. All right, everybody. I don't have any homework for you this week because the sutta just kind of stepped up in my place. So next week I'll give you some homework and about how to actually work with this attachment and begin to open up to it.